uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. Subti, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. Subti.com.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 64th Berlin International Film Festival.
Io sono Valentina Pompili al Tokyo International Film Festival.
Soy Antonio Becker y estoy aquí con...
Internationalen Filmfestspielen in Berlin. Mein Name ist Beatrice Behn.
Ahlan bikum fi Fred Film Radio.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to a bonus edition of the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by yours truly, Matt Micucci. And the reason I say it's a bonus edition is because officially we're on a 2-week holiday break. So for anyone tuning in, I have personally curated a program of some of our best interviews of 2021 with various guests from various film festivals, as well as previous episodes of this, our beloved show. So, wishing you a happy holiday and a happy new year. Fire up an audio teeny and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air. This is the best of edition of the Big Fred Tuesday.
Fred.
Angela Cherby, Fred Film Radio from the Venice Festival, here with Benedict Cumberbatch for the film The Power Dog. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Listen, you are playing Phil, which is like a kind of the evil machine of the old film. Is a kind of a cruel, brilliant, but vulnerable as well. So he has everything.
Glad you said vulnerable, because that is the sort of key of why he's cruel. I think he feels very threatened.
Yeah. And how was it to prepare for that? Because you need to convey everything inside one single character.
I mean, the book is a masterful blueprint. It's an extraordinary piece of prose, a real American classic. The script is a beautiful cut of that animal. And Jane is an extraordinary leader, and she gave me a long runway to sort of saturate and marinate in this character's psyche. And like Kirsten very, very kind of succinctly put it, you therapize with your character. You go into understanding one another, what of you is in that character and how to excavate that through all sorts of work. And also the manual work of trying to accomplish something of his mastery of pretty much everything he turns his hand to, which kind of could drive you mad, because he it's a lifetime of whittling and braiding and roping and riding and banjo playing and ironmongery and taxidermy. I mean, it goes on and on. The guy was really a polymath. But that's all to sort of build it from the outside in. The inside is the most important thing to hold on to justify his behavior in those moments that are shockingly cruel to us as an audience.
Yeah, which is actually what is weird for us to watch. That when he's by himself, he's actually himself.
This is the gift of cinema. You have a lens on you, and you are suddenly able to reveal something internal and private. And with, you know, with Ari's photography and Jane's guiding of the lens, it was a real gift for me.
And there is this
that was one of the big draws of the job, actually, was knowing how much non-dialogue there would be in this film. It's old school filmmaking.
All the scenes where you are solo, there is like your relationship with the camera is like you dance with it. It's really intense. It's really fascinating and wonderful to watch. How do you work with that?
Jane's got a capacity, I think, to really give people boldness and freedom to be literally naked, but vulnerable in an emotional sense as well, and just kind of, yeah, to really express their sensuality and not feel viewed, you know, to bring it inside and to find it in nature as well. I mean, that was the gift of this character. You know, this isn't sort of hot sex in a hotel bedroom. That's a very different kind of thing to abandon to. This is a deep commune with nature and his nature as well. But like you said, a private moment. And to have that, the wind in the trees, the horse's mane, the ripples of air moving on the water, the feel of the water on your skin, the mud, you know, it's a very visceral thing to abandon yourself to. And it connects you in a profound way to your surroundings and everything else. And you can lose yourself in that and just become a vessel for the story or that point for the character as a
and
gift.
And actually shows perfectly.
Great. Oh, good. Good.
Very well.
So, thank you.
Good job.
Thank you. Good.
Thanks a lot to Benedict Cumberbatch for being with us. I'm Angela Cherby for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Encounter is a new psychological sci-fi thriller starring Riz Ahmed as a father desperately trying to save his kids from a mysterious alien invasion. But the story becomes more sinister, mysterious and ambivalent as the film progresses. I had the opportunity to chat with Michael Pierce, its director, over a Zoom session. Let's take a listen.
I watched the film. I thought it was great. And there's so much that I want to ask you, but I kind of just wanted to start off with this blending of reality and genre and the real with the imagined. In this case, the sci-fi genre. What is the potential that you like to explore in mixing these two?
I think, I'm drawn to films that have one foot in a kind of observational reality and one in a subjective reality. I feel like it always feels like a new experience watching those movies. And I return to them a lot. Like I rewatched Mulholland Drive again the other day because I feel like I'm still trying to understand through whose eyes I'm experiencing the film and what is real and what isn't. And I just think, yeah, there's something really fascinating about doing that as you're doing a character portrait of someone who isn't sure what's real and what isn't. And what we were trying to do with this film is make a few kind of perceptual shifts so that the audience's investment in the character and their relationship with the character is becoming more complicated as the film goes on. Mm. I suppose, you know, the journey that you go on with Riz's character is thinking of him as a kind of hero to save it, you know, that is saving his children. And then he becomes something of potentially a villain, and by the end of the film he's an anti-hero, and it's a much more complicated character. So I think it just gives you a lot of room as a director to show the most complex version of your character when you're playing with those different perceptual shifts.
Yeah, well, that's definitely something that I'm going to want to return to as well, because he is very complex character. But also when I think of Beast too, I'm also noticing a similarity in the sense that these are characters that seem to be outsiders in a sense. And I wondered whether you, seeing as you're also the writer, in this case, the co-screenwriter of the film, I wonder whether there's a side of you that finds it easy to connect with these, with this type of personality, or maybe there's something that interests you in particular with these types of existences too.
Yeah, maybe I'm drawn to, characters that are on the periphery in some way, but I think that's also the same for audiences because, you know, deep down, everyone thinks of themselves somehow as an outsider. I don't know why that is, but we all identify with the outsider. There's always a part of us that has felt like that person at one stage or not in our life. And so maybe it just creates a very strong and immediate empathetic bond with that person. You know, there's a certain level of empathy that you invest in the person that, yeah, is on the periphery and is going through difficulty. So, yeah, I think that's part of it. But it's not really strategic in a way. It's not because I'm thinking like it's an easy route to get an audience's empathy. It's also a response to the material that I read and stories that I come across. You know, with Beast, it was a case where I felt there'd been so many serial killer movies that were either about the detective or about the perpetrator. And I was interested in this character that was on the periphery of that. It was the girlfriend of someone who's suspected of these series of crimes. And I wanted to put that person in the spotlight, you know. And I thought that their journey would be very epic and just as epic as the detective or the killer. And in this story, you know, Riz is playing a character that's been kind of wounded, and traumatized and forgotten, and has been left on the periphery of society. And I felt like he had a very epic journey that was continuing, even though, you know, no one knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, maybe it's a theme that will continue throughout future films as well.
A lot of that influence comes from films, comes from fiction. But then just in the same way that I was pointing out, this blending of reality with the imagined, the real with the imagined, is any of this inspired from the news? Because there's so much in this film that kind of reminds me of so much that we're hearing about in the news, from, of course, pandemic times to conspiracy theorists to just the tumultuousness of these times.
Yeah, I mean, you never write a film in a complete vacuum. Like, intentionally or not, you're always going to, like, absorb what's going on in the culture, and it's gonna be imbued in the material to some degree. I mean, a lot of it was already there in Joe's original script, you know, that there was this invisible enemy that was infecting the population. And he wrote that idea nearly 10 years ago. And we had no idea, of course, that we cut to 10 years' time, that there would be this plague ravaging the land and, you know, the population was becoming infected and you wouldn't know who. But then there were other aspects that were, I think, yeah, that I kind of, it was a response to what was happening in the culture. I think there were several school shootings happening when I was writing the script, and I was looking at American gun culture as an outsider and finding it, it's a very shocking phenomenon, you know, for us Brits and for a lot of other countries, the prevalence of firearms in America. And so I made a certain rule when I was writing the project that anytime someone pulled out a gun in the movie, they were going to exacerbate the problem. And it wasn't ever there to sort of, wasn't there as a solution. And that the sort of powerful weapons in the film were going to be compassion and understanding and communication. And that's not because I'm like a big moralizer. Like, I've enjoyed movie violence, you know, in some ways when it depending on the context. But it just felt for this film, it wasn't right and it wasn't sitting well with me, especially with regards to, you know, some of the things that were on the news. And then there were, yeah, other things, like you say, conspiracy theories or heavily militarized police response units that I was responding to as I was developing the script. But I'd say the main idea that Joe came up with, it was, you know, it was a decade before the pandemic hit us. And it was just strange that it started to reflect the world then.
Speaking of which, actually, we were talking about it earlier, the complexity of the character that Riz plays in this film. He is really, really complex when I think about it, because he's so ambivalent. I mean, traditionally, sometimes throughout the history of cinema, I guess, the figure of the hero would not have been questioned as much as perhaps it was in the 70s. But even now, I guess, in your film, he is placed in this situation where he could potentially be the unquestioned hero. But then as the story goes on, you see that there is more to it than that. Do you think that there's a reason why, and I'm asking you, obviously, as a filmmaker, there is this maybe honesty in portraying masculinity in these types of contexts and these types of narratives?
Yeah, maybe, you know, there is a cultural conversation, of course, that's going on about masculinity, or, you know, a buzzword is toxic masculinity. And I think a lot of that, you know, is fascinating to see that evolve. And there's a kind of shift in the culture about what is a positive portrayal of, you know, masculinity. I suppose what maybe is different now is that there's more of an embrace, at least in films, where a kind of hyper-masculine character can show vulnerability, you know. And I was quite interested that that be the climax of the movie. And that was going to be the hurdle that that character had to get over, you know. That were, you know, he's so driven to protect his children, and the identities of being a protector and being a hero and being a savior are very powerful identities for Riz's character, but they've kind of trapped him as well. It's meant that he couldn't expose his vulnerabilities to anyone. And yeah, so whether, you know, I don't know if we would have made this film the same way if it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I think that's, you know, that there's, it's a kind of extra freedom that you have now, that you can have a richer portrayal of a male character on screen. Yeah.
And when you say trap, then do you also mean maybe trapped in expectations that people have of what, I don't know, a man is supposed to be, a man in his late 30s is supposed to have? At some point in the film, without giving too much away, there is a character that lists things that he doesn't have and that could potentially make him dangerous. And I feel like a lot of people could identify with that.
Yeah. And it's maybe, I know it's a generational thing as well. Like, I know that when I talk to friends about our parents, you know, that they, there's a certain threshold when it comes to talking honestly and candidly about your feelings or what you're going through. That is just very, you know, it's a very different threshold than that we have as a generation. But I'm sure for, you know, our parents, they were more, you know, liberated to talk about their emotions than at least their parents were. So it's kind of, you know, it's slowly opens up. And I'm sure the next generation are much more like in tune and engaged with speaking about, you know, mental health issues or any vulnerabilities that they have. But I think, yeah, I think his character, I mean, me and Riz created a kind of rich backstory for his character from, you know, from when he was born and, you know, what drew him to go into the military and every stage of his military career. And what we landed on was that he was someone that was put into different foster homes and they weren't all good environments. And he never had a father figure to protect him. And he was very weak and he was very vulnerable and exposed, particularly being a South Asian kid in the area that he grew up. And so we thought that was a really interesting sort of origin story for the character. And the thing that drove him was that he was going to become the person that he never had when he was a kid. And he was going to become a protector. And that's what it was important to him. And as much as that's great and there's something noble in that, it's kind of, it's defined him too rigidly that he can't show weakness. And that's become his flaw. And he must need his children, the next generation, to, he must expose that flaw to them to help heal that wound. And so he's kind of, yeah. I mean, it's so kind of those kind of backstories, which are really interesting. That me and Riz didn't want to explain in the script, in the film, and I only wanted to allude to it briefly in the script. But it's important for me and him to know, as the you know, actor and director, to know what's brought the character to that stage.
Interesting that you would say that. I'm actually running out of time now, unfortunately, so I only have time for one more question. But thank you for sharing that about, you know, telling us a little bit about what shaped his performance, because it is a complex character. I wanted to highlight, though, that in this complexity, there is the film does offer occasional chances to smile, too, because he is trying to be charming to the kids. And so trying not to frighten them too much about the seriousness of the situation that they're experiencing together. And so I actually appreciated that as well. So just kind of briefly as a final note, how was that? Was it difficult to establish that dynamic with the kids too? Because essentially for a lot of the film, it's just the three of them and in an enclosed space in the car.
Yeah, I think once it was really about making the right casting choices. You know, I can't remember which director said it, but I'm probably going to misquote them. But it was something to the effect of like 90% of directing is casting right. And once you've got the right actor in the right role, you know, and the chemistry works, then you can sort of stand back a bit and let the actors, discover it for themselves. And so it was really important for me when I was doing the casting process that I found a very, you know, personal and deep connection with each of them. And so my instinct told me that if I can connect with them and I've, you know, and I found them very sort of genuine and generous actors and young men, then I thought that they were going to connect with each other. And so my job was to try and give them the space to discover that connection on set. And of course, working with children is, you know, it's a slightly different way that you've got to work. But for me, it was more about just giving them freedom than trying to coax a performance out of them. I wasn't trying to manipulate them to deliver a performance. I just wanted them to give them the freedom to find an authentic way to sort of explore the scene.
All right, Michael, well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, man.
Red Film Radio.
Red Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti from the 71st Berlinale. I'm in company of Daniel Brühl, director and actor in Next Door, screening here in competition. I wanted to know, in a sort of existential question, what came first, the desire and necessity of stepping behind the camera or the urge of exploring the contradictions of modern life, popularity, fame?
I'd had the desire to direct something for a long time, and I knew after all, everything I had heard from directors who were always telling me that you have to really know what you talk about in your movie, especially in your first one, that I was, you know, always thinking about an idea that would be, you know, personal, that would be, that would affect me, interest me, fascinate me. And then one day, sitting in a tapas restaurant in Barcelona, I had this idea. It was actually born in Spain. And then I couldn't do it in Spain for various reasons. main reason was that I cannot write well. And then some time passed, and when I moved in Berlin from one apartment to another, to a situation where I live at the moment, where you have the typical Berlin backyard situation, where you look in a lot of, you know, rear view windows, I thought it would be even better and more you know, relevant and interesting if I would transfer it to Berlin. Still, I had the problem that I cannot write. So, and then I found a production company that I joined, a distribution company, Warner in Germany, offered me the possibility to also direct something. And I was asked if I had an idea. And then I remembered this one again. And then I took all my courage and approached a friend of mine, Daniel Kielmann, because I knew that he would have the realm and he's, you know, the best writer we have in Germany. And because he's half Austrian, he might be also have an interest in the darkness, in that dark sense of comedy that I wanted and that the Austrians have, some of them. So I just tried it, and thank God he engaged immediately and was very enthusiastic about doing that. And then we, and then we started to write. Well, he wrote it, and I, fed him with ideas. And then after a couple of weeks, I had the first draft, and then I thought, like, I have a movie in my hands, and hopefully I can make it.
How much of the film is based on some self-obsessed colleagues that you met? I recall, for example, the scene in the film where he thinks that the couple he meets wants a photo of him. How much this is based on real life?
It is funny that you mentioned that, you know what, in Barcelona, it was a Swedish couple that approached me in a park. They were both blonde and looked like Germans from the distance. And so they came with the camera just towards me. And I thought, okay, they might be Germans. So the first thing I did was hugging the lady. And then they said, we don't know you at all. We are from Sweden. We want a picture from us. So that was, for example, a funny incident that I experienced for real. It was highly embarrassing. In this case, it is very personal. And deals with many things that I've lived and experienced. But it was not my intention to do a self-indulgent autobiographical tale about me. But it just helped me to tell a story that I wanted to tell, because my persona and my profession stands for something that is very appropriate to be attacked by another character in the movie, who is also a combination of people that I have been observing and met, and who also stands for something. I didn't want to empathize or sympathize with one or the other. I just, I also didn't want to betray one or the other. But I just felt that I was at ease to tell something about characters, and especially my character, that I know very well, a place that I know by heart. So all the way through, I felt like I know what I'm talking about. And it could have been an architect from Düsseldorf, or a politician from Hamburg, or what, a successful musician from Stuttgart, whatever. But I just always felt that it is much better if I create it around my real experiences. When the idea was born, I knew that I liked that idea, because I like Kammerspiele in general. Because it's fun to watch actors, play out their roles in such a, limited space and scale. But it was really a lot of work. And also, thanks to Daniel Kielmann's brilliance and ideas that he had, we managed to tell a story which is engaging enough so that the audience will hopefully feel entertained, you know, in these 80, 90 minutes in this room. Yeah?
Daniel, at a certain point, Daniel and his old neighbor seem to understand they have things in common, no? The way they lie to themselves, not facing up the truth. So I was wondering, was this a way for you in the film to show us that despite, you know, the cultural, social, or age difference, some struggles and contradictions are always the same, are within human nature, so to speak?
Yes, and it's actually, What also always fascinated me is the topic of neighborhood and neighbors and the questions of identity and background. I mean, I grew up in a middle class neighborhood in Cologne in Western Germany, and the borders to the working class and to the posher classes were very fluent within a couple of streets. So for me, it was very normal to be in touch with every kind of social and cultural and political background. In Cologne, this was really this was my reality. And then I become quite lucky and successful when I was quite young with Goodbye Lenin. And from that moment on, wherever I moved to Berlin or to a different neighborhood in Barcelona, I always felt a bit like an invader who had been very lucky and privileged. So that does something to you, because I experienced it and I still experience it every day. And even after 20 years, I never moved outside this neighborhood in Berlin. I changed the apartment 3 times, but I'm still always stayed in Prenzlauer Berg. And even after 21 years, I still cannot claim ich bin ein Berliner, because depending on which bar I go to, if I encounter Eastern Germans from a certain generation, I would always be the outsider. I would always be detected immediately as a West German. And that was something that fascinated me, that even after the unification, it would take another 20 years until, you know, we level more. But it is really not the case. And if you leave Berlin to the east, it becomes even more apparent. The countryside here in Brandenburg couldn't be more different than the countryside in my home area in Nordrhein-Westfalen, in the west of Germany. So I wanted to talk about this disappointment and frustration and anger that is visible, especially in moments of a crisis like now. And I also did not want to betray one or the other, as I said before. So it was very important for me, especially as it's told from my perspective, that the Eastern German neighbor is not just a Stasi, evil, Mephisto kind of guy, but I wanted to make him human with all the horrible things he does, to understand his motivation, why he does that, and that it is always a good thing to start a conversation, I'm glad that in my personal life I didn't experience a conversation like this, what I found interesting in this story is that people who have nothing to do, although they're neighbors and they live next to each other, above each other, but who actually don't interact, what would happen if they did? And I found it interesting that a man that you don't know tells you the truth that nobody else would tell you, and would even then, you know, have the power to destroy your life as you knew it. That was a thought that fascinated me.
And we'll be talking to Daniel Brühl, director of Next Door's screening at the 71st Berlinale in competition. And this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 78th Venice International Film Festival, and I'm very pleased to be joined by filmmaker Patti Panzeroli. Thank you very much for joining us. And actor Tim Blake Nelson, too, is joining us, and it's such a huge pleasure for us to have you here. I watched the film this morning, Old Henry, and I just thought it was such a great way to wake up in the morning, I gotta tell you. It was awesome. But Patsy, for the listeners who are not kind of familiar with the film yet, how would you kind of briefly describe it?
My quick log line. Basically, you know, it's a somebody who is living in the old West. You know, it's 1906. It's Oklahoma is kind of this place that's it's half Indian country, half Oklahoma Territory. So, and the modern world is slowly creeping in, and this is kind of the last rural untouched piece of the country at the time. So you have this farmer who's kind of hiding out in this really small piece of the world and trying to raise his son in a way that shelters him from his own wrongdoings in the past, as well as the modern world coming at him.
Yeah.
He wants to hold on to that, just to keep him a kid longer, as long as he can. And so trouble comes, and it kind of forces Henry to Tim's character to abandon that and decide, you know, he's got to step up and go back to his old ways and take care of business.
And Tim, you're absolutely wonderful in this film. And I just wanted to ask you, is this a place, a time and a space that you kind of like to inhabit, you like to get into and get lost even?
I do. I love period movies, and I feel that they ask more of an actor. You have to lift yourself to a period character because people moved differently in former times, and they certainly spoke differently in former times. And it forces an actor to think of a character as bigger than himself or herself. And I love doing that. I love subordinating myself to something bigger than me. And yet at the same time, doing it in a way that is intimate and believable and real, which in a sort of contrapuntal way demands that you're never seen doing it. You just feel like the natural character. And that causes you to need to be small with your work and restrained. And that's a really exciting challenge for me. So I embrace this sort of character. And frankly, I have what they call an old-time face, which has very much been to my detriment. So it's nice to be able to take advantage of it.
I love it. But speaking of the character, you play in this film, you know, he kind of escapes into the wild and into nature. Have you ever felt the need to do that in your personal life?
I have to a degree. And I was speaking with my friend Ethan, and he said, and during COVID, and I said, well, how are you handling it, Ethan? And he said something that could have come out of my mouth. He said, Tim, it's confirming the way that I would like to live my life.
Right.
And so the isolation is even something that I almost envied for the character, because I live in New York City and it's heavily populated and there's extraordinary light pollution and noise pollution, and one has to retreat into one's own quarters to find peace at times. And yes, sometimes I wish I were out away from it all, and it was great to explore that with this character.
Well, that's interesting. That inspires me to ask you, Patsy, a question. Do you think that the Western as a genre is particularly apt to the times that we're living in then?
I think absolutely. And, you know, Tim kind of touched on this in the earlier press conference, and it is a, you know, it's where we are. I'm going to steal some of your beautifully told story earlier. Where we are as a country is, you know, everyone's on their own. Everyone feels like they're on the right side. And that's what the Western is good versus evil. And so in everyone's mind, they're doing the right thing. And you know, there's no real law. It's just live or die. So I think the Western is, you know, I think it's very suited for right now. And as well as being, you know, living in the middle of nowhere and not wanting the outside world to come, you know, approaching. So,
Well, I'm sorry to say that we have to kind of wrap it up, but I absolutely love meeting you. Thanks very much for coming, and thanks for making this wonderful film. It's awesome.
It's been our pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having
us. Thanks very much. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Angela Cherby, Fred Film Radio from the Venice Film Festival, here with Jodie Comer and Matt Damon. Good morning.
Good morning.
Here for The Last Duel by Ridley Scott. A monumental film, very, very dense, very intense, very romantic too, but very powerful in terms of action. And it's, how was it to be in this film? How was it to work with Ridley Scott, Jodie?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it was a dream come true. It was a huge pinch me moment for me. You know, coming into this, I felt overwhelmed, but like ready. I was so hungry for the opportunity to give Marguerite a voice. You know, I think in history, women's voices are very much eradicated. So absolutely, the opportunity to give her a real sense of agency was so exciting. And then, you know, to work with Matt and Ben and Nicole and meet them and just have a really great working relationship was incredible.
Actually, your role is a very feminist role, you know. And Matt, you wrote it too, so you know. Why did you choose? I mean, this is based on true facts, but how do you work on these true facts while you were writing the film together with Ben?
Well, just in looking at the, it was we felt the best way to tell this story, and to, you know, we called it like the anti-chivalry movie, because really looking at what life was like for women, and yet we're raised on these movies, and women, you know, we're used to seeing movies and not seeing any women at all, and the idea of having these male perspectives and where the women kind of appear, they're almost conjured or manifested by the men whenever they kind of need them for whatever, for, you know, but other than that, they're overlooked and ignored. And then you get to the third act and this world of women appears that's been, you know, that you, even as a viewer, have been unaware of for the first two acts.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah, definitely.
That's so clever. I remember when I first read the script and I was like, well, where is she then?
And then and there she is.
Like, oh, and then you realize the kind of brilliance and the brains behind the whole format of the film, and how as an audience and as a society we can kind of be complicit in that and assuming that the woman is just going to be the wife, you know, this character is just going to be the wife of.
So. And she's the only one that actually speaks out.
Yeah.
She wants to speak out. Mm. She's not afraid. Even if they try to scare her a lot, you know.
Like reading the book, that was what jumped off the page. Yeah. It was like this woman's unbelievable courage and just the bravery of this person to just again and again stand up and say, no, this happened and I'm not going to be quiet about it. And, you know, even at the threat of, she obviously took incredible risks, which the film details, but what that takes for her to have done that was something worth making a movie
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. And listen, how did you, I mean, the three parts, it's kind of risky to tell the same story three times without being
boring.
Yeah. Exactly. I didn't want to say that, but it was it. So which kind of tricks, writing wise, you choose in order to avoid this?
That's a great question. So what we did is we looked at it and kind of broke out the story, the plot that we needed to kind of deliver. And so each story, like, we don't tell the same story exactly. There's only a few scenes that we go back to two or three times. Most of the time you're getting new information in each story. The first story is kind of a traditional knight's tale. That's from my perspective. And it's this guy who's going like, this is what happened and I was married and we were happy and I've been wronged.
Right.
And it's a very straightforward story. And so we put a lot of the exposition in there. So that's if we were going to err anywhere, it was in the first act. And then Adam's story starts and you immediately go, wait a minute, this isn't how this guy told it to me, right? And then eventually, once you get to Jodie's story, you realize what you've been looking at are two unreliable narrators, male narrators, and then...
Yeah, because the male perspective is always not exactly...
It's completely skewed, because as Ben, you know, put into words this morning as we were all talking, they didn't, you know, of the three narrators, the two men and the one woman, the woman is the only one that sees herself as a human being.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, thank you very much to Matt Damon and Jodie Comer for having been with us for The Last Duel by Ridley Scott. I'm Angela Cherby for Fred, the Festival Insider. Thank you
Thanks,
very
Angela.
Much. Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Fred.
Fred Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti from the 71st Berlinale. I'm in company of Radu Jude, director of Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn Screening in Competition. So, your movies in general, but this movie is also full of irony, sarcasm, dark humor. So, do you think this is the only way to fight racism, sexism, radical parties and views?
For sure not, and I'm not sure that the film I've done is a fight in a way or another. It's more for me a kind of analysis, and of course, because it is also a critique, it can seem somehow more engaged than it actually is in a way, and. Getting to that, I think if it has some humor or some irony or whatever it is, I think it's not such a conscious option. It has something to do with my nature a little bit, and also with the desire, which contradicts what I said before, a desire to see or to notice, let's say the comic angle of some realities, like Kundera has a famous essay, and he speaks about the comic side of sex at some point, which Puritans and libertines both don't want to see it because it makes this activity seem ridiculous and so on. And I think this is somehow true if you look at some activities from a certain angle, even us now, if you really, really take a step backwards, you can see how ridiculous we all are staying here and discussing that. I mean, it has a ridiculous side as well. But of course, it also has a heroical side. The fact that we go on and try to speak about films and cinema, and I'm very grateful for that. But we could see the satirical side of it, if you want.
The most interesting part of the film is the third part, because it brings up a discussion that goes in many directions with so many points of view. It says a lot in a multifaceted way. So how did you conceive it?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting, and it's a bit of shame that, but it's normal in this kind of discussion that everybody wants to know something about the topic of the film more and less about the form, because for me they are very connected, and I think the form of this film and of including this part, which is the form of a kind of a sitcom, of a comedy, of a TV cheap comedy, is very connected. So I wanted to subvert a little bit this language of television, which is usually for very cheap comedy, and to use this cheap comedy, but in a way that it's a little bit against the values of that television propose normally, or at least against the value of aesthetical values of TV or whatever platforms, this kind of stuff. And regarding the what happens in it and the dialogue, because it's of course based mostly on dialogue, they are mostly quotes or adapted quotes from what I found on the internet. And because I have two children, one is 16 years old, so I've been to quite a lot of meetings with other parents, and we have a WhatsApp group, so we can watch. You can see the values of a group of parents, from middle class parents, let's say. And all of a sudden, when they speak about children, when there are problems regarding kids, there's always a kind of it breaks down the barrier. People are more honest when they are trying to impose your values regarding the children. So you can see that. There's a lot of you can see the real values behind when people are talking about the kids. You see, I might give you one example, for instance. It's for sure that the head of the class, the responsible for the class was a mathematics teacher, and she had 1 hour per week in the kid of my school, in my school kids, in my kids' school, sorry. And she, once every week, she had 1 hour to discuss like civilization problems with the children, how to be a citizen, ethical problems, this kind of stuff. And the parents went mad about that and went to the school and said to the teacher, you must teach mathematics even in that hour, because we want our kids to be good at mathematics so they could go to good high schools. She partially did, because, you know, she didn't do it all the way. Then I'm very happy. She is a great person. But this shows that the parents want. They don't want their children to become good citizens and to understand the world around. They want them to be successful in the high school, then in the university, then in the profession, and that's it. So I think that's very limitative somehow.
Since we're talking about, you know, the endings, I wanted to know more about the idea of having like 3 possible endings and exploring the most extreme one. That I have to say, it hit me in the face. It reminded me of the sometimes the same feeling I had when I watched films like A Clockwork Orange, for example. Plus, there was a woman, like you know, being violent in a way. And I found it at the same time, like, very feminist. And I thought that it was extremely representative of every nuance, you know, and in the way men and women are. So I wanted to know more.
Well, the structure of the film, as I pointed at the beginning on the credits, is that of a sketch. Meaning that now I have to stop from saying that, because there were reviews where people say, well, it's just a bad sketch and that's it. It's nothing more. The film they wrote at the beginning is just a sketch and that's what it is. So it doesn't have any value. And so I will change that. I will say that it's a treatise on that, a treaty. But the structure is that of a sketch. I mean, it's not fully put together. It's some things are a little bit longer than maybe they should be. Something are a little bit repeated. It's a little bit more rough. It has a roughness, I think, the structure, which I want. I'm not able maybe to make a structure which is completely full circle. So this is why I kept the 3 endings. It's like everybody could choose which one of them considers his or hers. And that was the idea. And of course, maybe the last one is like a fantasy, but it is a male fantasy more than a woman's fantasy, probably. So it's like what I would like to do to people that stuck on my nerves, and maybe a woman wouldn't think of that, but this is what it is. The film is made by a white man, heterosexual person, and that's it. I assume that.
Since the film has only been presented to press and industry, how do you think the film will be perceived by the general audience?
Well, I don't know how the film will be perceived. I think the good thing of a film is to put it in front of the viewer, and then they can attack the film, then they can like the film, they can praise it, they can thrash it, they can... And if the film... I never have... Or maybe at the beginning of the first films, I was a little bit, when I was reading a bad review, a little bit felt, you know, bad or guilty or... I don't know, and not anymore. I think I like bad reviews. I think if the film is good, it resists to all the bad critique. If it's bad, it doesn't resist to the good reviews, you know? So I really want the reviews and the reviewers and the film critics to be much harsher with every film possible. I would destroy, if I would be a critic, which I cannot be because I'm not able to, I would destroy 90% of the film without pity. Well, I really think that a film should be an occasion for a debate, for discussing values, for discussing whatever, for a discussion.
And we've been talking to Radu Jude, director of Bad Luck, Banging or Loony Porn, screening at the 71st Berlinale in competition. And this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 2021 Rome Film Fest, and I'm so pleased to be joined by one of the most distinctive and strong voices in American filmmaking today, Sean Baker. How are you?
Oh, that's nice. Good, thank you.
presenting Red Rocket here at the festival. I just watched it this morning. I thought it was awesome. There's so much that I want to ask you, but I guess the first question that I wanted to ask you is related to the term suitcase pimp. Is that a real term? And what is it that attracts you to this type of person?
Well, I didn't know about this term until I was, you know, doing research in this world and realizing that it's a term applied to these men, male talent in the industry that lives off of female talent in the industry. And what drew me in? I would say it was really getting to know these men, hanging out with them. On the surface level, they are charming and appealing and funny and entertaining. So I was actually enjoying my time with them, laughing, etc. Going home at the end of the night and letting everything they said sink in and thinking, why was I laughing at that? Huh, okay. And being very torn about my what I felt about these men overall. And so I wanted to actually tackle a character study that would put the audience in the same mindset and have the audience just as torn. You know, do I root for Mikey or do I want Mikey to go down in, you know, in flames? And so hopefully that's what I did. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. I absolutely. That's exactly how I felt while I was watching the film. Mm. A couple of things, too. I mean, just the setting of the film, too, I thought was just amazing. It's almost like you're stepping into a timeless place, you know, where time just moves differently. It's also profoundly American. Is that also important, the American part of the film here?
Well, yeah, obviously, you know, the oil and gas industry, very important to the U.S. economy, but also extremely controversial, especially globally right now, you know, with the fossil fuel debate. So, you know, I also wanted to show that this is how people are living. These are livelihoods. And so not to take that lightly. So again, there was that balance of, you know, of different sensibilities. And also, I have to say, just as a director, visually, the refinery row is amazing. To have like the twisted pipes of rust and metal and steam and flames, quite visual. So it helped me in many ways have the location become a character.
Yeah. Well, it definitely did feel like it was important. Yeah. And just in terms of that, too, I also kept thinking of the concept of the American dream. Mm. It almost feels like the protagonist of this film still embodies that. And do you feel like that's still a thing, you know, the romanticized idea of the American dream?
I think at one time the American dream was simply about being happy, raising a family, and... and hoping that your kids did, you know, had a nice life. Yeah. I think that was just surviving was the American dream at some point. And now the American dream has been distorted and contorted into just a pursuit of like fame and money and power. And I think that's I'm tackling that, but I'm also tackling sort of like the unfulfilled American dream or the failed American dream, at least in the way that Mikey he gave up on that dream and he returns to a place he never thought he would have to return to and has to deal with that and cope with that new existence.
It's interesting to consider that also in terms of pornography and the role that it has played, I guess, to some extent in a version of the American dream. Now the pornography industry is also radically changing.
That's what part of the reason why the film takes place in 2016, because there have been so many changes since then. I mean, with the rise of platforms like OnlyFans, sex workers, sex performers can actually just manage their own careers, and so it has definitely changed, and it will continue to, I guess.
I wanted to. This is the last question because I don't want to make anybody angry. I could talk with you forever, but Simon Rex.
Yeah,
what a fantastic performance! Yes. I don't think I've ever seen him better in a film. So
that's nice to hear. Well, he's amazing. I have had my eyes on him for like 3 decades because we're essentially the same age. So I've watched his peaks and valleys and his way of always tackling the next. Like he was a VJ back in the day. Then he was a comedic actor, a comedian, a rapper, and then he did great on on social media. He always continued to entertain me. And I always thought, why hasn't he been given like a real meaty character? Like I would. And so when Red Rocket rolled around, I'm like, I guess I'm the one who's going to do it.
Sure.
And I'm so happy. I mean, he was so wonderful to work with. He's so talented, so motivated, doesn't have that Hollywood diva thing at all. Like he came in and was ready for our crazy guerrilla filmmaking. I mean, it wasn't nice. It wasn't great for him. He didn't have a trailer. He didn't have, we were eating pizza every day. I mean, not Italian pizza, like yeah. shitty Midwest pizza.
Any donuts in the crafts table?
we said, we're all like, let's not eat any donuts. Let's be responsible. By the end of the last day we were shooting a donut hole, we were all eating donuts.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, Eddie, we got to go, but it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. You're great.
Thank you very much, man.
Thanks a lot. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, I hope you enjoyed revisiting some of Fred's best interviews of 2021. But even as we end this special broadcast, don't forget that even throughout the holidays, you'll be able to tune into our 24/7 broadcasting channels and website to check out more of our stellar content and interviews. Recommended for all film fanatics and cinephiles out there, of course. Till the next time, this is Matt Micucci signing off. Stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
This is Cristiana Palmieri for Fred Film Radio from the Sydney Film Festival.
My name is Roberto Pombo, here on Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Io sono Laura Buffa e questa è una nuova puntata di Fred Mag.
Mein Name ist Beatrice Bien und ich spreche mit Andreas Prochaska.
Fred, the Festival Experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.